Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading this in-depth interview from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear Russ Baker, editor-in-chief at whowhatwhy.org. And he's going to detail their powerful expose published about a week ago about the fascinating connections between Donald Trump and an array of Russian figures. Some are criminals, some are mobsters, some are both. And unlike so much of the speculative reporting that we've seen about Trump and Russia in the last 9 months, Who What Why's investigation is based on named sources and documents, not secret leaks and anonymous voices. I think you're going to find this really fascinating. And it's all made possible by people like you who support my work here at peterbcollins.com through your subscriptions. Folks like Wendy Gebauer, Lydia Dolan, who just took out a new annual subscription, Paul Tomaselli, and Cynthia Von Hendricks. I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com and check out your options. You click on Menu, then click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and you can take it from there. Today on the Peter B. Collins Podcast, a complicated tale of Donald Trump's connections to Russian mobsters. And as compared with much of the reporting in the corporate media today about Trump and Russia, this exclusive investigative piece from whowhatwhy.com is actually based on documents, not leaks. And its sources are not anonymous, they are named. Our opening music today from the late Jerry Garcia, it's his Russian lullaby. And this is not quite a bedtime story. Russ Baker joins us once again, the scrappy investigative journalist who heads whowhatwhy.com. Hello, Russ.
Hey, Peter. Always a pleasure to do your show.
Well, thanks for being with me today, and congratulations on a lengthy expose that you published about a week ago at whowhatwhy.com. And let's credit your co-writers, C. Collins, that's just the initial C, and Jonathan Z. Larson. First of all, you have my compliments, as I mentioned in the intro, that I didn't find a single leak referenced in this story. I didn't see any anonymous sources. And the kind of journalism that you're doing is so valuable today at a time when we see reports that are based on leaks that then are reported on by other outlets and become treated as fact. Like, for example, the claim that Russia hacked the DNC servers. We still don't have any evidence of that, yet it is treated as fact, and then other elements are built on that shaky foundation. So you're practicing the fundamentals of journalism, like the name of your organization suggests.
Well, appreciate it. We do try to adhere to the most honorable aspects of journalism. We do a lot of our work with documents. We try to get a hold of and scrutinize documents. We try to talk to as many people as we can. And then we work collegially. And I think that's another thing that sort of distinguishes us, not only on this piece where there are three co-authors working together, but we have a larger circle of people within and outside of Who, What, Why, with whom we discuss these stories in trying to figure out what do they mean, what's significant, you know, why should people care. And then they go through this tremendous editing process with a whole bunch of editors who go through and ask lots of great questions. And at the end, usually, whatever it is, you know, we feel pretty good about it.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is that you have been a longtime and credible critic of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And I think this is really important because over the past year, certain people have surfaced who were critical of what James Comey did in July to say that there would be no prosecution of Hillary Clinton. And then he popped up again in October and in early November. And, you know, I consider the FBI to be a rogue agency. And I think James Comey needs to be held accountable for many of the decisions and actions that he has taken. And going back to the case of Whitey Bulger that we'll reference again in a moment, the Boston bombing and the murky death of Ibrahim Todashev behind an FBI bullet in Florida, you have really distinguished yourself as a sharp investigator of the investigators.
Well, appreciate that. You know, when we look at any institution, whatever it is, we try not to do so through rose-tinted lenses. And that is one of our critiques of much of the media, both the establishment or mainstream sort of corporate media, and how they know from repeated experience and from history about the very serious problems that you refer to with the Bureau, with other apparatuses. And so, you know, this is all known, and yet the default position every time is to go back and just say, well, the FBI says, as if it's gospel. And then, of course, you have folks who, understandably, I mean, are very, very critical of the FBI really all the time. We're not critical of the FBI all the time. We think there are people in the FBI who are dedicated public servants and trying to do the right thing. And, you know, you need some kind of institution like that. But, you know, I'd have to agree with you that the problems are tremendous. They've always been there throughout most of the history with J. Edgar Hoover. But long after Hoover's death, they're still there. It's still a little bit of a mystery how the Bureau is run, who makes the decisions, because it's not the President of the United States. I think arguably it's not the Attorney General, supposedly above the FBI. And even arguably it's not someone like James Comey. Those people come and go. There's a kind of an institutional value system and a institutional memory. And then also, of course, there's a tremendous amount of compartmentalization and secrecy within the FBI. So whether it is, as you put it, a rogue agency or not, it certainly is a problematical one. And it's one that, yes, I have to agree with you that we need to have much more control over.
The central thrust of your lengthy piece, it's over 6,000 words, is that the FBI has had a long-running investigation into a cluster of criminals and Russian mobsters, many of whom who have used Trump Tower as their base of operations. And their location is not, as you point out in the article, any smoking gun of connections to Trump personally or his sprawling business empire. But I want to start here by going to the summary of your piece. You say, to sum up, Who What Why's investigation suggests that the FBI, in using an informant with a strong connection to Trump and alleged ties to Russian mobsters, including one deemed a national security threat, has seemingly tied its own hands, turn page, investigating the president. This makes it difficult for the Bureau to pursue the president's long-running proximity to mobsters, including gangsters from the former Soviet Union, and to those with close connections to the Russian president and oligarchic elite. This, in part, could explain the FBI's odd behavior and the confusing back and forth on what the government knows about Russia's interventions into the 2016 election. So, with that as the thumbnail for our listeners, I want to next talk briefly about Whitey Bulger and how you have exposed that while he was a paid FBI informant for years, he continued to conduct his criminal operations, even reporting them to the FBI on a daily basis. And that's a model for Felix Sater, who we'll talk about next.
That's right. I mean, what we've been looking at is this relationship between Trump and this fellow Sater. In a nutshell, he Sater came on the FBI's radar because he was involved with a criminal Wall Street operation that was essentially bilking unsophisticated investors. At some point he turned, I guess, and cut a deal. We know he cut a deal with the authorities, and he became a cooperator. Now, what was he cooperating with them on? Back in the 1990s, Russian, or let's say organized crime, originating in the former Soviet Union, both Russia as well as Ukraine and the Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Georgia, all of these places. These people began having a considerable influence in the United States. FBI kind of late in the game discovered this and started becoming very, very alarmed. Initially, the threat seemed to be their involvement in Wall Street. Then they later decided that it was really a threat to the whole financial system of the United States and maybe even the world. And that was in part, Peter, because they had recruited not your normal kind of hoods that you think of as involved in La Cosa Nostra, you know, sort of shaking people down and threats of violence, but actually some very skilled and highly educated people, computer scientists, mathematicians, and what have you, that they had recruited all these people and that they were able to use technology to gain an advantage to commit crimes in the stock situation and in the financial system. And so they became very, very concerned about the long-term consequences of this. But then it became clear that this organized crime in Eastern Europe was also involved with other people who had left high level of the former Soviet Union, including people who had access to military armaments and even nuclear weapons. And so this became both a high-level criminal investigation involving finance and of potential threats to national security. And it was in that environment that Felix Sater was determined to be somebody who had connections into that syndicate and could help the FBI understand and essentially penetrate and, I suppose, disrupt its operations. And so that really is the beginning of the story. Sater is involved with a company that moves into Trump Tower around the early part of 2001, 2002. And then not so much later, that company, which is a real estate development firm, starts working with the Trump Organization, developing major projects in New York and around the world. And so that's the beginning of that relationship. The FBI is handling this Felix Sater the same time that he and Donald Trump are personally working together to get these projects going.
And the sequence of events is that first Sater is involved with a stock fraud company, a pump and dump operation called White Rock. Then he moves over to Bayrock, and the way you describe it, he seems to muscle out the others and take control. He's described as a 60% or greater owner of that. And Bayrock proceeds to develop properties with the Trump brand. So this, you know, business connection is pretty strong. You also point out that Felix Sater had a suite at Trump Tower, where he was able to internally walk upstairs into Donald Trump's office. And sources apparently told you that that was something that occurred frequently. So he was not just an arm's length partner. Certainly Trump, in his real estate ventures, appears to have hundreds, if not thousands, of limited partners and other partners around the world. But this seems to be a repeated, ongoing partnership relationship.
Well, that's right. And by the way, just to kind of go back a little bit historically, as we point out in this article on our website, whowhatwhy.org, the Trump Tower opened in 1983, and almost immediately, a fair number of the biggest tenants, the ones with the nicest apartments on the highest floors directly under Trump's own triplex, turned out to be criminals. and people with connections to both Italian organized crime, La Cosa Nostra, and also people from the former Soviet Union. And we document in that article, we have a list of those people. So there's already interest in some of those people by the FBI, even prior to their full awareness of the sort of so-called Russian mob influence. And so that's what's going on in the building. That's very, very important to understand that. And Trump is personally dealing with some of these people, some of these criminals. And so then you have this Bayrock moves in. And yeah, I mean, they're not just one of many people who are interacting with Trump. You have to remember that Donald Trump's, despite his so-called vaunted skills at making money, he actually lost huge amounts of money. He had invested very, very heavily and dominated Atlantic City, and that proved disastrous.
A real bad bet, yeah.
And without going into too much detail there, he really was down. And in around this period, we start seeing not just Bayrock and Felix Sater, but any number of different people from the former Soviet Union pumping money into deals and programs with the Trump organization. There's actually a quote in that article from Donald Trump Jr. where he's in the former Soviet Union, and he actually makes a public statement that money from the former Soviet Union is key, I believe, a majority of their monies. And then you've got this Sater and the people who partner into this thing. And Sater, as we understand it and as he asserts, came up with the whole idea of this very fancy hotel, Trump Soho Hotel and Condominiums. It's a, you know, dominant building downtown today in New York. And that Sater came up with this idea of franchising the name all over the place, and that he would go and travel. And it's very interesting because they had bilked people of $40 to $60 million, and he faced potentially a very long jail sentence and a huge financial liability. But the FBI decided to basically let him off scot-free with a $25,000 slap on the wrist. And they themselves stated that he was tremendously helpful during this period. And they actually, despite the fact that he was a convicted criminal, not just for that, but for something else, an incident some years earlier when he attacked and slashed a man with a margarita glass in a bar. And he had also been barred from, you know, working in financial stuff. And so nevertheless, there he was with all these big deals. And so he is basically taking the Trump name on the road and selling it, you know, essentially sort of licensing it to all kinds of partners all over the place. Many of them, these people with mysteriously huge amounts of money, we emphasize that the Russian oligarchs, the money, you know, it's not clear how people made so much money virtually overnight. But certainly there are real questions about that. And a lot of those kinds of people show up in these configurations. And we see, very importantly, Peter, those two pages of tax returns from 2005. This isn't a period where you would have thought, based on Trump's reversals, that he wouldn't be making any money. But he shows himself to be making an enormous amount of money that year. In fact, it's so much money, it's more than major billionaires who were, you know, known to be doing very, very well than they were making as their bottom line reportable income.
And the 2005 returns that were sent anonymously to David K. Johnston also indicate that gross income was $100 million higher, because he took, I think, $103 million in undetailed, they're not detailed on the summary form, write-offs. Some of that could have been the loss carry forward from his nearly $1 billion write-down of the Atlantic City losses. And Johnston, who I've known for many years and interviewed over a dozen times, he's followed Trump for over 25 years. And what I see here is that Felix Sater was the pivotal character who enabled Trump to convert from being a bricks-and-mortar developer with the heavy debt load and the responsibilities that come along with it to a guy who merely licensed his name and, you know, received help healthy license revenues on an annual basis from hotel and resort operators in other parts of the world. So that fundamental shift of the business operations, the business model of Trump, your article suggests, is based on the work of Felix Sater. And let's pop this here. Donald Trump today says he can't really remember Felix Sater. And gosh, did I know him? And you cite trips that he took with Trump and Melania to Colorado, with the kids on business trips to Russia. And today they've got Alberto Gonzalez amnesia. I can't remember. I don't recall, Senator.
Yeah, that's right. And it is very hard to believe. And even if you give him the benefit of the doubt, I mean, as you put it, if this is the man who essentially helped Donald Trump convert his entire way of operating. And by the way, we run a second piece on whowhatwhy.org, focusing more on Sater and on his background. And there's a wonderful little quote in there where he talks about his role in all of this stuff. And there's a quote where he refers to his Trump card, mm-hmm. how he would go around the world. And as you point out, I mean, after what happened was he was involved with this Bayrock company and he was using a false name, but Felix Sater, double T instead of singular, ostensibly so that, investors and people involved with him in business would not be able to look him up and see that he already had a criminal record. Mm-hmm. But obviously Donald Trump, who was dealing with this man constantly, must have done due diligence with him. You don't just go into business with somebody, and he had a pretty good sense of who the man was. Anyway, the New York Times in, I believe it was 2007, discovered that Felix Sater, and exposed this piece of it. And then he left Bayrock unraveled, and then he went on to do his own thing. At this point, as you point out, he's now in Trump Tower, not in Bayrock, but in the Trump Organization. And they've given him office space, the email address, his own business cards that, say Felix Sater, consultant to Donald Trump. I assume Donald Trump was aware that he had those cards, and certainly they interacted directly with each other extensively. So it is hard to believe that there's any way that he couldn't remember this man, who, by the way, is, sort of striking looking also, and apparently fairly charismatic. Very, very hard to imagine that he didn't know who he was. And maybe later on in this conversation, we can talk about how Sater reemerges in the Trump circle this year. So if he didn't know him, what's he doing in the Trump circle in 2017 as Trump is becoming president?
Well, let's do pause the narrative here for a moment, Russ, because I want to share with our listeners the source material that you use to research and write this piece. And it appears to be kind of an accidental discovery by a former Bayrock employee who found a copy of the FBI agreement, the cooperation agreement, that Sater entered into with the agency. And that led to attorney Fred Oberlander. And again, this is so different from all the corporate media coverage and the Rachel Maddow hoo-ha that we're seeing, so much of which is driven by anonymous leaks and sources that, we are not permitted to know. And so this led to the discovery of a hyper injunction in this case. Please explain.
So basically, this gentleman working in Bayrock, a real estate development company, thought that a particular man ran the company. That might have been questioned if you consider that the man really didn't speak English. Another odd thing about this. But in any case, when he found this thing, he suddenly realized that he was in the midst of an ugly situation. And so he went to an attorney. And that was this Fred Oberlander. And he said, "What do I do here?" And at that point, they realized that he was potentially on the hook for all kinds of liabilities, because if you're involved with somebody who has a criminal record and they're not, that's not revealed, you're essentially a party to that. And by the way, this also could potentially affect Trump himself vis-a-vis Felix Sater. But in any case, for a variety of reasons, he got a lawyer, and they began pursuing what became a long-range legal action. And in the course of that, they've sought to obtain all kinds of documentation. And this gets us into another chapter of this whole thing where basically the U.S. government has done everything in its power to prevent these people from obtaining information about Felix Sater and Donald Trump and their relationship and what was going on.
Now, this hyper injunction is a new part of the law lexicon for me, a layperson, and it kind of reminds me of the language of the late Senator Arlen Specter, who talked about super duper precedents in Supreme Court confirmation hearings. But is this hyper injunction legal? Can the Court of Appeals partially seal what appears to be this FBI cooperation agreement and related details about Felix Sater?
Well, we don't know, and I suppose maybe there's an expert who knows, but we haven't found one. And those lawyers, Oberlander, and then not only did they attempt to suppress this, they attempted to go after Oberlander if he talked to reporters, anything. He was essentially gagged, and they went after him for trying to get his law license revoked, going after him for so-called illegal ethical violations. It was very aggressive. He then had to have his own lawyer, so the lawyer has his own lawyer, and they've been pursuing this ever since. But they say that this hyper injunction, and we have the same sense that it's extremely unusual. You talk about the so-called nuclear option. It's a very, very hardcore thing that may not have really been used before in this country. In these kinds of situations, as the FBI, the CIA, and so on, they regularly try to argue on any front that they can to these judges, whether it's in a FISA court about surveillance, wiretapping, and so forth, or in other sorts of courts, they try to go into a judge's chambers and say, Your Honor, there's something very, very sensitive here, sources and methods, national security, what have you. And the judges almost always go along with them. And so this is this unusual thing where they're really just telling this guy, you can't do anything, you can't say anything. And we understand that he was told that he could not inform Congress. And of course, that's very interesting because that's another branch of the government with an important role as a check and balance on all of this.
Well, that suggests collusion between the executive branch and the judicial branch to deny Congress the oversight rights that it rarely exercises, particularly with the FBI.
Oh, that's right. I mean, it certainly looks like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Russ, next, let's talk about any connections to Semyon Mogilevich, or Mogilevich, who you describe as the boss of bosses of the Russian mob. And in your answer, please describe the elements of the Russian mob, because it's a little bigger and the tentacles go deeper than our notion of the mafia, for example.
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, the Russian mob recruited this unusual caliber of individual, but they also, of course, have hitmen and all the other usual stuff. Basically, Russian organized crime existed, or Soviet organized crime existed back when there was a Soviet Union. And although on the one hand, the authorities jailed a lot of these people, they also worked with them on things. They would have them do certain things, and there were relationships between the KGB and organized crime. And when these people left the Soviet Union, they were helpful in other places. And we know that certain businesses run by people from the Soviet Union were very helpful in obtaining electronic equipments and things. They owned stores and what have you, and they were able to get these sorts of things that the Soviet government entities like the KGB and what have you, GRU and so forth, they needed. So there was this sort of two-sided relationship, on the one hand distancing, and on the other hand cooperating with them. What happened was in the 1970s, when there was an effort to let some Russians leave, particularly those who were claimed to be Jewish, although some of them might have been their heritage, they certainly weren't real adherents, and many of them falsely claimed to be, they were able to leave. And the Russian government took the opportunity not just to let people like the sort of the Sakharovs and what have you, the very distinguished and eminent people, but they empty their jails. And a lot of these people were able to pour out and go to various places, including coming to the United States and settling largely in the Brighton Beach, Coney Island section of Brooklyn. And so that was already back in the 70s, and then more and more of this. And of course, when the Soviet Union collapsed, what you saw was a lot of these people leave, and you also saw the flight of capital. And now you had all of these apparatchiks in the former Soviet Communist Party seeing an opportunity as everything fell apart. Here were all these state enterprises, and they saw an opportunity to grab them for pennies, basically. And once they grabbed them, suddenly they were able to sell these things off or get contracts and so forth, and they were tremendously wealthy. Now they had all this money, and what were they going to do with it? I think they were justifiably worried about the unpredictable turns of the situation there in the former Soviet Union, and they wanted to get the money out. And now you get into money laundering. And money laundering, typically, you look for businesses and solid assets you can put it into. One of the best, supposedly, for money laundering is real estate. And this gets us again to things like Trump Tower, buying all of these properties. You know, it's very interesting about this. You may know this story, Peter. I think it's in our article. This man in down in Florida, this man, former Soviet Union fellow, is a billionaire. And, you know, he buys Donald Trump's got this mansion. I'm not talking about Mar-a-Lago. It's another place. It's,
right.
You know, waterfront mansion, and he buys it at a super premium, gives the Donald way more than he had paid for it not that many years later.
It's about a $60 million flip.
Yeah. And then then he raises the property. You know, he just removed, I mean, it looked pretty good to me. You know, he just wipes it out. Like, I guess he had so much money, but that's very interesting. And so anyway, you know, who is and isn't, and I'm not going to make any particular allegations about this man or anybody else, who is and who isn't. And frankly, to your question about this whole, you know, the origins, it's important to note that experts believe that it's very hard to draw a line between the Russian state and organized crime, that there are so many relationships and so much cooperation. Who's a legitimate business person and who isn't, that none of that means anything anymore. And in fact, quite a few people have said that Vladimir Putin and Semyon Mogilevich are close and work well together. And I might mention that Mogilevich, the so-called boss of bosses, sent a man, Ivankov, to the United States to manage the situation here. FBI got a tip that he was in the U.S. They couldn't find him. And when they finally found him, he was living in Trump Tower. He must have gotten a tip off or something because he disappeared and they couldn't find him. And when they found him next, he was in Atlantic City at Trump Taj Mahal. Now, this is the guy running, we are told, the Russian mob in the United States. So that's obviously very, very interesting. And then that man eventually back in Russia, and he tells someone, maybe it was an offhand remark, I don't know why he said it, that Semyon Mogilevich and Vladimir Putin were extremely close. And shortly thereafter, walking down the street in Moscow, he is assassinated by a high-powered rifle from a sniper.
Well, Russ, clearly you in this lengthy piece examine a lot of these questionable connections between Trump and people with ties to Russia and specifically to Russian mob activities. And you've already identified one vulnerability that Trump, by consorting with a known felon, may have entered into agreements where that was not properly disclosed to the other parties. And in that respect, he may be vulnerable to civil or criminal exposure. Do you find any other possible criminal behavior that you can link personally to Donald Trump?
Well, you know, one has to be careful with this sort of thing, and I'm not a lawyer. I think the the big issue here is that the kind of money you were talking about, whether he was making $120-130 million as his net in a single year, which we need to remind people is actually an enormous amount of money. I mean, you and I know it's an enormous amount of money, but because we never get near that kind of money, we don't know how enormous it is. It's extremely enormous by anybody's standards. But as you point out, there may have been even more in the picture after once you consider those the long-term deductions.
Mm-hmm.
So we see, you know, by their own admission, again, Donald Trump Jr. and so forth, talking about how most of their monies in that period was coming from this former Soviet Union. When you consider that, and when you consider that those monies in the former Soviet Union were, to some extent, to some large extent, considered to be criminally gotten, I think he's right in there in that game. And I don't see how you get around that. I mean, maybe I'm missing something, but I don't know what it is.
Early in your article, you raised the question that is an obvious one, and that is, given what we know about this, what turns into a 30-year FBI investigation, what appears to be a decision to continue to pursue this without disclosing it to key parties, including the American voter, in time for people to take it into account before the November elections. And so it's certainly murky and messy. And the, you know, difficult thing I think we have in trying to process all this is the extent to which the FBI would pursue this investigation over the broader and, you know, certainly more immediate issues of, you know, whether Trump is compromised and suitable to become president. It appears they made the decision to protect their long-running investigation over the more immediate concerns I just mentioned.
Well, that's right. That's really a key issue for us. And if you look at Comey's behavior when he brought out this thing about Hillary Clinton again, you know, this thing with the Anthony Weiner and what have you,
mm-hmm.
You know, that whole thing, obviously that impacted the election. I think all of the analysts and experts agree that that was enough in a very close election. And, you know, there are different theories and analyses and explanations of why he did that. We do hear that he was under pressure from the New York FBI office. And of course, it's New York FBI office is the one that was running Felix Sater.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to note, and this is I believe, very significant, that not only were they running him at some point and could have been for many years, but they seem to have continued to protect that. And in fact, as we note in this article on whowhatwhy.org, a couple of the U.S. attorneys, all these people were involved in supervising this thing, handling his plea agreement. And you know, they went in before this judge, these U.S. attorneys, these FBI people, and they talked about what a wonderful asset he had been, incredibly important, extremely helpful. We don't know the nature of that. We don't know whether they're right. In some cases, it turned out, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, with Whitey Bulger, this mob boss, the FBI got as a cooperator, we know that he continued to actually have people murdered while he was working with the FBI. So we don't know what was involved during that period. But what's very interesting is they all go into the judge and they talk about this terrific guy and how helpful he's been. And then a couple of them leave government, a couple of these U.S. attorneys, and they go to work for this law firm. And now what are they doing? They're representing Felix Sater. I mean, I find that amazing. And another couple of very interesting things is that that law firm, that same law firm that those two go into, ends up being selected by Donald Trump as the law firm that is going to oversee his assets when he becomes president, and there's an issue of conflict of interest, which to me is astonishing. And then we find out, as if you need any more icing on the cake, that that law firm has a major practice in Moscow, that it is so influential there, it wins some kind of an industry award as the Moscow Law Firm of the Year. You know, what's that all about? And then, to top it all off, you've got these couple of FBI agents very involved with handling this guy, and they leave the bureau and they start a private security firm, and their client is Donald Trump, candidate Donald Trump. You know, and one of them, we have their pictures in the article, you know, they're from what we've heard is that he was accused, I won't say accused, of, you know, manhandling people at Trump's rallies, you know, really being very, very harsh with them. But I mean, that's quite interesting. And in fact, we don't know that that relationship ever ended, because Trump went to the White House bringing in not just Secret Service, but his own outside security contractors. So
let's name the names here, because you cite Exmark Partners as the security firm, and the principals there are Ed Deck and Gary Uher. And Uher, you identify as the agent who investigated and handled Sater after his cooperation agreement. So this really does beg many, many questions. And you also add the element that Loretta Lynch, who was the last attorney general in the Obama administration, would have known about this case because she ran the U.S. attorney's office there in the district there, the Southern District. I'm sorry, the Eastern District. And so that would indicate that she was a party as the nominal boss of James Comey, the FBI director, to the suppression of any information about investigations of Trump, including what Comey acknowledged at the March Capitol Hill hearing, that an investigation of Trump began last summer. So the conflicts here are really stunning, and you have detailed this and addressed it in a way that, frankly, shames the corporate media, Russ. It's powerful and important and very impressive.
Well, I appreciate those kind words. You know, just our organization, I don't know if folks know this, we are a small organization. We're a nonprofit by design. We don't have any shareholders or owners or commercial interests. Not just that, but we don't accept any advertising of any kind, which means that we're able to do this work. It's only the only limitation we face is where we're going to get our funding. And we turn to people like your audience. We turn to the public to support our work. And that's, you know, that's really who owns us, the public.
Well, I want to endorse your very low-key appeal here, Russ. Many of my listeners are very generous to me, and I know some of you are pretty well-heeled. So take a look at whowhatwhy.org. Look at the work that they've done on this story, and be as generous as you can, because there's certainly more investigation and digging that needs to be done, and we're not seeing it come from the well-funded corporate media outlets. There was one other head-scratcher here. I didn't know that Paul Manafort was a resident of Trump Tower. And when Trump fired Casey Lewandowski last summer and brought in the troika of Manafort, Conway, and Bannon, he didn't have to go very far to find Manafort. And, of course, with his now well-publicized ties to Russian and Ukrainian interests, it just makes this even more intriguing, Russ.
Well, that's true. And, in fact, there are even more layers of this onion, which in that article at whowhatwhy.org go into some of these things, including Ukraine, as you point out. And there we see a whole to-do which kind of sets up the eventual Russian efforts to control and occupy parts of the Ukraine. And it involves natural gas pipelines, and it involves very wealthy, you know, again, oligarchs, Putin's interests. And we see the boss of bosses, Semyon Mogilevich, again mentioned in there. And there is Manafort and Stone and so forth, all these same players. Felix Sater is traveling to Ukraine in that period. Donald Trump Jr. is traveling there. It's a complicated but extraordinarily rich and important story.
And Russ, I wouldn't expect you to expose your hand too much, but what are the obvious questions and leads that you're likely to be following up based on this initial investigation?
Well, we're actually following quite a few leads. We published, as I said, a second piece on Felix Sater the other day. Mm-hmm. We have a third piece that's largely done, and a fourth piece and a fifth piece. So if we've got the backing of the public and the support and the ability, we intend to stay on this story. It's an important one. It's unusual. It's always interesting and important things to cover. But if you think about the magnitude of the basic questions being asked about the loyalties and interests, values and relationships of the president of the United States, there aren't many stories that are more important than this.
Yeah. Well, Russ, I go way back. Watergate was my first big story as a young radio host in Chicago. And it really led me to that coupled with my coverage of COINTELPRO at the time and the murder of Fred Hampton, really kind of scarred me for life and left me with the cynicism and skepticism that I think is necessary to approach these subjects. And you've got it in good doses, and I'm looking forward to your subsequent installments. I want to urge listeners to go to whowhatwhy.org, read the articles that are there, and then bookmark it so that you can go back for more as it rolls out. Russ Baker, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Russ Baker. Your comments are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.